listener production.
Shares. Market. The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday mailbag edition. There's a Wednesday edition coming up, at least for a recording. Stay tuned for that one. I am Scott Phillips. He is the triathlete, the marathon, ultra marathon runner, the mountain climber, the ocean swimmer. He is the man, the myth, the legend. He is, of course, Andrew Page. Mr. Page, how are you, sir?
Pretty good. I should probably be sore after all that.
You know, the regular Strawman references were bad. Now I'm just kind of... I'm nothing if not consistent. I have a habit of grabbing onto an obsession, not letting go. So at the moment, you are your athletic prowess is what is going to be talked about, because you won't let me talk about Strawman, which, of course, as we all know, was either a private or a premier online investment club.
One of the two.
Maybe even both.
Maybe.
There you go. I'm liking the idea. Mate, how's your Sunday morning going? You're obviously back. You've ice bathed. You're rubbed down. You're sauntered. You're ready to go?
No, just some light yoga this morning, mate. Took it easy. It's a rest week.
I like it, mate. I like it. From ultra marathons to a little bit of light yoga. I'm liking that. What's your favorite yoga
pose? Mix it up. Oh, gosh. I've already stepped out of my depth here. Downward dog? Sounds familiar.
There you go. That's the only one I know as well. That's okay. What I would have gone with. Could you name a second one?
No.
No, me either. Mate, let's get into some questions.
The stretching buffoon I do particularly well.
I don't even stretch. I'm just a buffoon. Let's just remind our listeners, if you didn't catch Friday's episode yet, or you did but haven't done anything about it, we are recording our next podcast. The very next podcast you hear will be recorded, assuming everything goes well, will be recorded live on the Gold Coast. Now, if you're in Peru and you want to fly to Australia, especially for the podcast, I would highly recommend it. However, if you're not, but you happen to already be on the Gold Coast, you're probably more likely to attend. This coming Wednesday evening, we are going to record a couple of live episodes, actually, next Friday's and next Sunday's episode, recorded live in front of a live studio audience. No more 80s TV references. Well, I was going to say, I promise. I can't promise. None for now. Probably. So we're going to record a regular Friday episode and a mailbag episode, in which case the mail will come from those in attendance if there's some good questions. So if you've always wanted to have your question answered on the pod, if you want to really see whether Andrew Page does have hair or it's just photoshopped on, that is a great opportunity for you to come and find out. Come and say g'day. Come and talk about... Don't talk about Bitcoin. Talk about anything else you want to talk about. We're here. We're there. We're going to answer your questions, as we always do anyway. But if you want to see us in person, meet some fellow listeners. Buy yourself a beer. It's going to be a pretty relaxed, kind of comfortable atmosphere. I dare say Andrew and I may well have a beer on stage while we're doing it. Not for the effect, just because, you know, man's not a camel. It's going to be a lot of fun. We look forward to having a really good time. I believe you might be able to buy some food there. So it's just, you know, the details, by the way, fool.com.au/money. Come along. We'd love to meet you. We'd love to have a full audience just to have a bit of fun. Andrew and I love doing this podcast because, frankly, we just like to chat about investing in the economy and life and stuff. We kind of get a bit broad these days, but we enjoy doing it. But we are doing it because we're hoping to add some value to you. And if you do enjoy it, if you want to be part of that conversation, then please come along. We'd love you to be part of that. So fool.com.au/money. Again, if you're listening to this after the 27th, please don't come along because we're not going to be there. We're only going to be there on the 27th. Although if it works well, by the way, if you're in another city, put some pressure on your Gold Coast friends, because if it works on the Gold Coast, we may be able to take this one on the road a little bit. So if it doesn't work on the Gold Coast, by the way, if it's just Andrew, me and the local dog, then we probably won't do any more of them. But if we do it, if it does work, you never know. You might see us in your city sometime in the future.
I'm liking the sound of a road trip.
Road trip. Oh, me too. Yeah. I love a road trip. I would rather drive than fly, can I tell you? I went to Melbourne for a speaking gig about, maybe it was almost 6 months, 12 months ago. And I thought I could drive, I live in Barra, so I'm an hour and a half, 2 hours out of Sydney. Thought, like, drive to Sydney, fly to Melbourne, get an Uber from Melbourne to the venue. I was like, you know what, fuck it, I was going to drive. So I did. I jumped in the car, I drove to Melbourne because it was just more fun and more interesting. So it was good.
Plus, as a parent, like, driving in a car is one of those few alone times that you get. So you can...
That is true.
I can listen to what I want to listen to. And there is a peace to be had when you're behind the wheel.
My YouTube playlist, I was thinking about this only this morning. I dropped my homework off school, actually, and I came back. I thought, I'll put some music on. So I go to my YouTube music thing, and I hit, you know, my super mix or whatever, so, you know, just a random selection. It must think I'm about four people because in between the Dance Monkey and whatever else I hear, I think there's some country music going on, some 80s rock, and then we're back to some, you know, 2024 pop thing that he heard from school. It's a pretty special playlist. I am looking forward to the day, not in a hurry because I love my unblock and I love having the kids around, but at some point my playlist will again be mine. For now, it's a very, very weird mix.
Yeah, although those algorithms can be very sticky. Like, you know, there's things I searched once. 3 years ago, and YouTube keeps saying, hey, you might be interested in this. Like, I'm really not. Can you stop showing me this? You know, for all the promise of AI and the rest of it, it's kind of like, come on. Like, is this the best? You don't know me at all, do you? I know I'm throwing you some curveballs here with the kids, but seriously?
Yep.
Anyway, you'll be back to Neil Diamond and
bring it on
BG soon enough. You know,
not
BGs,
not BGs. Neil Diamond for sure, definitely a Neil Diamond fan. Bit of Australian and US country. I can be a bit partial to that.
Fair enough.
A lot of 80s rock. A lot of 80s. Can I say one of my guilty pleasures? I love a power ballad. And it was embarrassing at the time. It's even more embarrassing now. Oh, a bit of Lady and Reeb, Chris de Burgh, top of the voice in the car. Absolutely.
Yeah. Brilliant stuff. Oh, yeah. I'm more of a disco man, but you know, let's not go.
I can imagine Saturday Night Fever, a bit of John Travolta, wide lapels, shiny
such
shoes,
a broad array of, you know, awesome funky beats.
See, now we're back to the Bee Gees. I'm tipping you're a staying alive kind of guy. Am I right?
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Hey, this is again not even slightly related. What is your go-to karaoke song?
I'm not a great karaoke fan.
Really?
Karaoke is one of those things that if you've had enough to drink, it can be fun for you, but then it's always painful for everyone else. It's one of those things too that you kind of think, time is relative, right? And a 3.5 minute song from someone who's too much to drink and can't sing is a long 3.5 minutes. Yeah.
Yep.
So I don't really have one, but maybe Bohemian Rhapsody if you put a gun to my head.
Oh, Bohemian Rhapsody. That is a big call for a karaoke song. That's not easy.
I don't like to brag, but you know, Freddie Mercury was okay. But you know, I put a new spin on it.
Sweet Caroline is obviously an easy go to, but I don't mind belting that one out. A mate and I used to do "To All the Girls We've Loved Before" as Willie Nelson and Julio Iglesias, which was always. If you don't know that song, listeners, again, it's the Silent Century type reference. So work with me. That's always good fun. What else have I? Yeah, that's probably the they're the go tos.
Yep. Let's just not do a live podcast at a karaoke. Can you promise me that?
Or live karaoke the podcast?
No, I like to keep the audience. Thank you.
Listen next Friday, just in case I convince Andrew to break into song. A Bohemian Rhapsody may be coming to a podcast machine near you. Hey, speaking of which, Lucas emailed us, mate, and said, "Hi, I'm Lucas, and I'm 11 years old. Me, my brother, and my dad listen to your podcast, or as you like to call it, the pod machine, thank you, Lucas, every day on the way to school." Mate, that is awesome. Thank you for listening. "I have two questions," says Lucas. Oh, Lucas, why? "Firstly, how much money do you think I need to begin investing? Secondly, why does Scott have such a big problem with Bitcoin?" Jeez, Lucas. Oh, Lucas. Oh, why did you have to do that? Given I've got to answer the second question, Ram, you can answer the first one. How much money do you think Lucas needs to start investing?
These days, you can do it super easily. Like some of these apps that do what are called fractional shares. So let's say, I don't know, you want to buy some CBA shares. What are they, $100 or something right about now? If you have $2, you can buy $2 of CBA shares. They split them up. Yeah, like the fees aren't great. And I know the purists will be saying that's not how you do it. You know, I used to sort of say 2,000 is a good starting number because it means that the brokerage isn't too onerous. And it just tends to make more sense. But honestly, I think I don't want to sort of nominate any particular company, but there's a bunch of them out there. Just do that.
Yep.
You know, save whatever you can save each week and pop it into that. And it gives you a real flavor for it all as well. So it's just, it's a great introduction to it, I think. That being said, if Lucas, you happen to have, you know, a few grand shoved under the mattress or, you know, grandma's been particularly, you know, kind at Christmas, it's not, it's, it's not too onerous to set up an account, you know, with your parents, and they'll designate it in your name. But it is unnecessary, I would kind of say. Mm-hmm. And I'll give a little plug. I've done it before. Create a free strawman account, right? Just log on. You'll have a paper money portfolio. We'll give you $100,000, pretend dollars, and muck around with it. Like give you a bit of a taste for it without exposing any real money to it. So there's a bunch of different ways.
Nice. I will jump in very quickly. I used to be the same as you, mate. And you know what's funny? And this, I've said this before. The older we get, the less absolute we are. You and I both. And yep. I think you want to keep your fees low, right? That's absolutely what you want to do. And if you have the choice, pay less fees than more. That's obvious. I think everyone gets that. What I would say, Lucas, is it's one of those things where if you wanted to... Don't pay more than you have to in fee, okay? But here's the thing. The habit of investing, getting started, getting going is actually what this is about, particularly at your age, mate. I am stoked you're 11, you're looking at investing. It's so good. So please do. Grab, you know, jump in, get invested, start. The fees are the fees, and the fees isn't great. And, you know, it's not a big deal. Just do it anyway. How little? $10. Start with $10. Just get invested. I think I've said to you before, my young bloke's actually your age, Lucas, and he's got a Sharesies account. It's not a plug. I do have done some work with him. He's got $100-something in the account at the moment. It's gone up a bit, which he's happy about, and he's now thinking about himself as an investor. So just get started, because you start to get used to what investing looks like, how it works, all that kind of stuff. Just get started. By the way, Lucas, sorry, Dad. Maybe, Dad, you can cover Lucas's brokerage fees so that he can invest smaller amounts and be covered for that. So I don't know. I don't know if you're in a position, Dad, and I'm not sure about your brother either, Lucas. But maybe Dad might be able to tip in for the brokerage, and maybe you guys can invest your money. That'd be my suggestion. But yeah, mate, just get started. It won't matter in the fullness of time. By the way, if you think about you're investing $10 now in maybe 10 or 20 years' time, you're investing thousands of dollars at a go. If that sounds like an amazing amount of money, it is. You will get there, and you will be... Hey, by the way, ask your dad if you don't know already, Lucas, to tell you about Warren Buffett. He started investing at 11 as well, mate. So you might be the next Warren Buffett if you get started. I reckon that's a pretty good goal to aim for.
Although Buffett does complain about not starting earlier.
That's his biggest regret, is not starting earlier. Yeah. That's okay, Lucas. If you can be a billionaire, mate, you can complain about not starting earlier too. But it'd be nice. Yeah. Not, look, well, I'm not Warren Buffett. You're not going to be Warren Buffett, Lucas. But if you start and keep going, develop some really, really great habits, mate. Make a game for yourself. See how much money you can collect. At the end of the day, you can maybe quit work early, mate. If, I know you're not working yet. Work's great, by the way. Work is fantastic if you find a job you love. We talked about that on Friday. Do something you love, and you'll never work a day in your life. But by the same token, money, don't make money for the sake of making money. Make money for the sake of giving yourself some life choices. That's the best thing you can do with the cash you accumulate.
That's what money's
second
for.
Second question. That's what money's for. Second question. What do I have?
Speaking of great money.
Speaking of things that are allegedly. So here's the thing, Lucas. I don't have a big problem with it at all. Look, honestly, Ram and I kind of, you know, this is entertainment as well as education and a bit of fun. So he and I play it up. I don't have a big problem with Bitcoin. I'm not anti-Bitcoin, never have been. I have an approach which is about my, you know, we talked on Friday about being fundamental bottom-up investors. And I just, for me, Bitcoin doesn't fit my investing framework. So neither does gold, neither do other things. And so I don't have a problem with it. I never tried to discourage you. I'm not saying you should sell your Bitcoin or not buy Bitcoin. What I have said is, for me, it doesn't meet the criteria I would use to make an investment, which is it produces nothing. There is no profit. There is no cash flow. There's no dividend. And that's just what, that's why I choose to approach investing. Andrew will say that's the wrong approach, and I may well be very, very right. Certainly Bitcoin's gains over the last year or so, it's just he's right and I'm wrong. But that's why. So I don't have a big problem at all, mate. I do worry about people speculating in assets that they don't understand well enough. I don't want anyone to buy Bitcoin who does it because they think the other guy is, or because, you know, maybe it's going to do something, or maybe it's this, or maybe it's that.
I agree.
That's how money is lost across. Yeah, exactly. That's how money is lost across the board, right? People who have, maybe, you know, John next door is investing in this, you know, dodgy thing. I should do it too, just in case he's right. Terrible reason to invest. If you do the work and you end up on Andrew's side of the equation, you say, you know what? I'm convinced this is going to be great. I want to buy some Bitcoin. Then do it. Do it. Here's the thing about Andrew's investing, by the way. He started with, and he said this before, as an anti or non-Bitcoin kind of guy. he got to the point over years of getting to the point where actually he now has a high conviction in Bitcoin. That's exactly the way to do it. Don't do it because your mate says so. Don't do it because you looked at it for 15 minutes and decided it was a great idea. Don't do it because you want to make a fortune and you think maybe this is the lotto ticket that lets you do it.
Don't do it because I like it.
Right. Well, yeah. And same with woolly shares, by the way. Same with any, you know, don't do the work to make sure you know why you're buying it, as Andrew likes to say, know what you own and why you own it. You know, if you convince yourself, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, mate. I don't do it. I've not recommended it. So I, by definition, I suppose I could have at any point said you should buy Bitcoin too. So, but that's not anti-Bitcoin. There's a million things I don't own and haven't recommended. Bitcoin's one of them. So is News Corp. So is Coal. So is, you know.
Well, the better analogy, they're all perfect, but an even better analogy is you don't invest in the yen or the USD.
There you go.
You know, it's probably perfect. A more apt one, right? It's like you've got the choice. Yep. I mean, they're perfectly valid currencies. You know,
correct.
You could hold your wealth in the Australian dollar or in any other. Correct. You know, just head to the bank and switch it across. So that's the better way to look at it. But the point remains, and I didn't want to hijack the point, which is you don't do that either. And
yep, correct.
And within that context, that's perfectly valid.
Yep. So, Lucas, yeah, I should probably be a little clearer every now and again. It's mainly just theatre, the way I carry on with Bitcoin. Just Andrew's so pro it, it makes it more fun for me to.
It's good to have it. It is good to have a bit of balance. And,
exactly. Yeah. But no, that's why. Hey, here's a question, mate, from James, who says, you can mention my first name. And again, as a tip to regular listeners, put that at the top of the email, not at the bottom, because by the time I get to the bottom, I may well have given away your name. So James at the very top says, you can mention my first name, !! So I have. Hi there, Scott and Ram, says James. I'm a long-time listener on the Pod Machine. I'm a happy share advisor member and second-time questioner. I have a question about earnings per share and how to frame and analyze a business's performance through the lens of both organic growth and inorganic growth, more specifically, when earnings growth occurs via acquisitions. Typically, says James, higher rates of organic earnings per share growth are a positive indicator for a business. And at times, it is usually straightforward to see how it's come about, such as increased margins, cost efficiencies, bolt-on product offerings, the list goes on. However, in my experience, I've noticed the waters get muddy when EPS growth starts to occur via acquisitions. Sure, on face value, when earnings are compared to the prior corresponding period, it looks great in the financial reports after an acquisition is settled and earnings are accretive. However, acquired growth comes at a cost to the business and shareholders in some shape or form, such as increased debt facilities, issue of new shares, which creates dilution, etc. How should we, as investors, process the effect that acquired earnings per share growth that is gained through acquisition has on the overall health of a business, whether it be when looking at an active acquisition or analyzing past acquisitions that a business has made to ensure management has a track record of effective capital allocation? Thanks again for your time and efforts. Full on, James. This is a really, really great question, Ram.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I mean, the stats are, and I probably need to update this, but I do remember reading this a number of years ago, that on average, 1 in 3 acquisitions adds value for shareholders. 1 in 3 doesn't really do anything. And 1 in 3 destroys value for shareholders. And it's really a question. So you can't just sort of say good or bad. And look, we've mentioned Pro Medicus more than a few times on this podcast. You know, it acquired a little German software company when it was like, when Pro Medicus was 60, 70 cents a share, something like that. You know, now it's $100. And that is the core of the business. And that was everything. That was beautiful, right? Like without that, you wouldn't know their name. So
that's it's a dollar stock. Yeah. Yep.
You know, and the way to look at it is the same way that you look at things now, really. It's just like, except that it's the company is investing capital. So they're, you know, the lens through which CEOs and decision makers and insiders and boards should look through and what you should look through is what is the relative return compared to the cost of capital. In other words, if I've got a very high conviction, high probability idea where I can make an investment and get a 20% return, or more technically an internal rate of return that might average 20% over the duration of that investment, I really should beg, borrow, and steal everything I possibly can, you know, to make that happen. As long as my cost of capital isn't above that, because it's always going to be a benefit to me. And The wrinkle in it all is when it is equity funded. That is, you're issuing more shares. And this is where you've got to be careful because, well, you've always got to be careful, but the risk here is, and you see a lot of examples of this, when you look at a company's statutory earnings or their revenue and they're going up, but on an earnings per share basis, they're not. Because the money that you have raised, the shares that you have issued to raise that money hasn't really delivered any kind of return. So it's been at best a wash or perhaps a degradation for the business. And the reason that would be the case is because they made a bad investment. Either it was a bad business unit or they overpaid for it. And that is always why you've got to be careful with acquisitions. And I agree, it does make looking at the financials harder. The technical approach is to sort of do some of the parts kind of stuff, but even that gets harder when there's synergies that are unlocked and, you know.
As soon as they're back together, you can't separate them. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is difficult, but the business will usually give you enough information to at least get a bit of a read on that kind of stuff. But you are absolutely putting your faith in the capital allocation decisions of management. No management team has ever come out and said, hey, we're about to make this acquisition. We're a bit 50-50 on it. It is always.
It could really suck, but we'll try. Yeah, exactly.
It is always going to be sold. And not because they're being mischievous or anything. They believe it. Like, this is going to be brilliant. But as I said before, 2 out of 3 times it's not. So you do have to be careful with it. But when it goes right, and when you've got someone who's a practiced capital allocator and acquirer done well. I mean, let's Google Constellation Software, Canadian software business. This whole, one of the most successful businesses on the planet is entirely built around acquisitions. So, you know, when done well, it is a thing of beauty. One final word and I'll shut up is tread carefully around what are called roll-ups. So there are lots of businesses out there where they try and create value through scale. So the classic one is childcare centers, or maybe you have legal practices or accounting practices. And you get this sort of mathemagic kind of stuff where 1 + 1 = 3. It's like I put these businesses together and the whole lot trades at a greater amount, supposedly because I get greater back-end efficiencies and I'm able to bring some of my sort of corporate might to aid them in give them some competitive advantage. And, you know, I basically play a multiple arbitrage game where I can raise money on the market where my shares are at a P of 20 and acquire businesses on the private market that are trading at a multiple of 4. It can work out really well. But what you tend to notice with certain roll-ups, a lot of roll-ups, is that the individual businesses themselves don't have a lot of organic growth. All of the growth is sort of engineered to some degree, and that's fine. It works actually insanely well right up until the point it doesn't. And when it doesn't mean that the business goes bust, but it means that the growth engine is gone, which probably means that the growth multiple is gone as well, which probably means that makes it even more hard to sort of continue to do that arbitrage trick. So yeah, don't shun acquisitions for the sake of it, but do tread carefully.
Yeah, that's a really great answer, mate. What will I add? If you're looking after the fact, James, if shares are issued but the company still has positive earnings per share growth, then the earnings have well and truly covered the new issuances. So don't double count those new shares that have been issued if you're looking in hindsight. If earnings per share goes from 20 cents to 25 cents and the share count's already gone up from 100 shares to 120 shares, then they've more than covered the dilution. So don't double discount the dilution. If it's future, you absolutely need to make sure you allow for that. And again, give yourself a margin of safety. If a company says, yeah, we're going to buy this thing and it's going to be roughly flat in terms of earnings, like, well, why would you go to all that risk and trouble and hassle and spend all that money on the off chance you might possibly make the same amount of money per share you're making now? That's crazy. That's crazy talk. So be careful of that sort of stuff. I think Ram's point is right. There are lots of ways to skin the cat. Financial engineering is perfectly reasonable as long as it's sustainable and as long as the price you pay is fair. G8 Education, one of the kind of companies that Andrew was saying in that education space, wasn't necessarily a bad business. The market just assumed that the growth could go on forever via acquisition. And so it was actually largely an investor screw up. I mean, the business wasn't great, but they never claimed to be better than great, or at least maybe they did. But either way, it was investors who kind of drank the Kool-Aid and went, well, hang on, when they keep acquiring forever, they'll give massive. It's like, well, there's only so many childcare centers out there. And at some point, the music's got to stop. And so
look at ABC Learning before GA.
That's the other one, exactly. But it can work. So I'll disclose, I own shares in corporate travel management. They have grown I don't know the numbers now. I haven't done it for a while at an aggregate level, but for a long time, they targeted growth via acquisitions and organic growth of roughly the same percentage each year. So kind of, you know, a 5% in organic and 5% acquired, for example. And they kind of did that. They delivered that for years and years and years. COVID was a bit of a mess, and so the numbers are a bit screwy now for all those reasons you'd expect. They've actually done a really, really good job of that so far. But again, if you assume they can keep acquiring forever and pay that sort of multiple, eventually you're going to have your backside handed to you because you'll pay too much for that sort of business. When growth stops, you're left, you know, use the musical chairs analogy from Friday. You end up in the same kind of situation. The other thing is, it's easier to analyze businesses that grow organically, but then it's easier for everyone to analyze them. So generally speaking, mispricings are less likely to happen. You know, Woolies that grows 5% a year every year, doesn't issue shares or anything else, really great basic business to analyze. But if it's that easy and it grows that slowly, you're very rarely going to get mispricing because the markets get that roughly right. So there is one of the challenges with investing is the harder it is to do, the better the chance you're going to get some value. Whether it's a small company like Andrew tends to focus on because not a lot of people cover them, so there's a very good chance it's mispriced because people don't understand the business. Whether it's a business that grows via acquisition where it's like, well, we don't really know what's going to happen next, so the market discounts it. Maybe there's value there. Maybe there's not, by the way. Maybe it's still overvalued. But it's also true that, you know, sometimes those nettles are worth grasping because there can be value there. Just recognize it is higher risk, maybe higher return, maybe not. But you're right about the question. Start with organic. As you go on your analytical journey as a amateur or professional investor, start with the easy stuff. So start looking at Woolies, understand that business, understand how that grows and what's there. And then think about, okay, what if a business like that was to buy some other businesses? How would I think about that? How would I make it work? The last question though, mate, I think I would suggest don't overthink it either. Your last question was how should we as investors process the effect that acquired EPS growth has? And you say at the end, to ensure management has a track record of effective capital allocation. The track record's relatively straightforward. If you've got enough history, you'll see exactly that. If it's been the same managers there for a while, yeah, make sure that's true. If someone's been running the company for 10 years, you can see through their results whether or not they've allocated the money effectively overall. Now, they may have had a bad acquisition and a good one, and the net result might be still positive or the net result might be negative. You can't look at every individual one, as Ram said. You can't separate out the synergies. You can't. They won't always report the individual business units separately. You can only look at the total. So again, it's one of those roughly right rather than precisely wrong kind of questions in my mind.
Yep. You know, one of the things I look at a high level, like if I'm just sort of like, oh, someone mentions a company and I'm not familiar with it and I'm just having a quick scan, I usually open up, I don't know, my ComSec account or something, go to the financials and, you know, what's sales and earnings, sort of just generally what's the direction.
Nice.
But another thing I do watch is the share count. They give you a line item there and just there is something, again, not necessarily bad, but is something telling about a company whose share count has grown significantly over the years versus one that has not had to. And it's just like the only increase is a few, you know, remuneration shares and that kind of stuff. That is a very good sign of a company that's capable of standing on its own two feet and being and not relying on the currency of its own shares. Now, again, I want to be hastened away. It might not be bad. There are some companies who have done that incredibly well. They've issued lots of shares, but again, that capital has been put to very effective use. So that's like, fine, I've got extra shares,
right. Yes,
but earnings per share has still gone up. So
100%.
You know, weigh all that together. And one very technical point, which probably doesn't really make a huge difference numerically, but companies in their statements will usually quote earnings per share using the weighted number of shares outstanding over the year. So if they did a big capital raise towards the end of that period, that extra share count won't be fully recognized. So you can just go to the ASX website or to even the company announcement page and whatever platform you're using and just look at, what are they called? Appendix 3Y sometimes you can infer it from substantial shareholder notices. Just what are the shares outstanding now? Because they were usually, and there's an incentive to err towards not the full number and still by say, well, that was the weighted number of shares outstanding.
Exactly.
It's not the number of shares now. Yeah. Now, again, it doesn't usually make a huge amount of difference, but it's something worth eyeballing.
I want to share one more thing about acquisitions, mate. And this is one that I almost never hear people talk about. When it comes to company growth, this is not necessarily a cynical approach. I'm not saying companies are being cynical, but let me take the cynical view because it helps illustrate we can work backwards. If I ran a company and I wanted to get 2 years worth of earnings growth, not earnings per share growth, earnings growth, you know what I'd do? I'd buy a company halfway through the financial year. Because what that does is that gives me, so I buy the company and let's say it's profitable, then I get 6 months worth of profits added to my financials. So year on year, I'm comparing the original business, plus I get 6 months worth of the new business. And look how much I've grown the company. Now, that seems like it's obvious, right? In year two, you don't have to make any more acquisitions because the new company you bought now adds 12 months of earnings, not just the six in the first year. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, I've doubled my earnings I get from the acquired business year on year, plus my other business I have. So mm-hmm. any acquisition that's made during any financial year, unless it's on the first day of the financial year, adds to that year and then adds to the second year because you get a full year of earnings all of a sudden, where the previous year, you only got half a year or 3 months or 9 months of earnings. And again, I'm not saying people do that deliberately to try and muddy the waters, but I will say if you're looking at growth, you can get 2 years of growth out of that. The second year in particular is one very few people notice because you think, well, okay, last year they made an acquisition, this year they didn't. But you really, really, really need to be careful. It's why companies, when they do, retail companies, when they do same store sales, compare like for like, only those stores have been open for 12 months already, which is exactly what you should do. And any company should do this. Sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't. But worth just being very, very careful of, because it can be one of those things that occasionally, either as I said, deliberately companies might do it to try and mess with you, or they don't, but you can as an investor be messed with yourself if you don't recognize. You need to allow for that. First, the acquisition. Secondly, the full year of earnings when the previous year was only a part year of earnings.
Yep. Yep. Very well said.
Mate, Patrick has a philosophical question for you. Well, for us, mm-hmm. but I'm going to make you answer it first because it's what I do. Okay. Hi, Scott and Andrew. A question for the podcast, please. What are the investment questions you have? What are the things you want to know? I don't mean things like, how do we time the market or can we time the market, which you know the answer to, but things that still haven't resolved properly, but you think can be resolved. Thanks for the pod, Patrick. I love this question. It's a really, really good way of kind of, you know, really scrubbing the gray matter and trying to work out. What would you like to know, mate, that you don't yet know the answer to, but you think probably could be known in time?
You mean what I would want to find out about a company specifically as part of the research process, or just me as a person wanting to know?
I think he means investing in general. So he's saying questions you have or things you want to know, not things you already know the answer to, but things you haven't resolved properly but you think can be resolved. So I assume you're talking about just investing kind of approaches or investing philosophy, I suppose.
I feel, better or worse, I've comfortably settled into my framework. it's working.
You know the answers already.
It ain't broke, don't fix it. So I don't know all the answers, but I know the questions is probably the better way of putting it. And I really start out like embarrassingly dumb. Before I've even looked at a share price chart or anything, I just want to know, like, what do you do? I mean, how do you make money? What product or service do you sell? How is that? What problem does that solve for the customer? What other ways could the customer solve that problem? Do you know? Is the customer likely to continue to want your solution or maybe more of your solution? Will more people want more of that kind of stuff? You know, that's if I can't get, and again, there's a lot of companies I can't get past that stage on, right? Really. It's like, and I mean, really get that. That's the kind of things that I don't know that I think could be known that I would want to know. But if I can't know, I'm happy to sort of like, right, swipe it aside and go there. So I think that's where I go in terms of investment approach. It's just, and then layering it up, and I will keep picking at it and keep digging while ever it remains interesting. But usually the more common approach is as you dig, you find something that's often a deal breaker. Like I find that one thing out, it's like, not interested. Usually it's something like, well, you're in a very commodified industry and you're very hard to, your only edge or hope of an edge is one of operational excellence. Is very rarely a pillar I like to lean on. But yeah, I feel as though I'm not really getting to the essence of it. You might have a better luck at it. But in terms of that's what I want to know and I want to try and know, I'm starting out at that point. And then before I've even looked at a financial statement or anything like that, I think it's something that too easily is glossed over. And I think those that do just start looking at numbers and go, look, I don't really understand. Oh, they do some kind of corporate back-end software kind of deal and rah, rah, rah. But look, earnings per share growth has been really great and the dividends, you know, it's not that they're unimportant things, but I feel as though you actually, no, stop. They're all good things to look at, but come back. And I'm big on the keep it simple, stupid principle, the KISS principle. And I think that'll serve you very well as an investor. I'm probably way off the mark.
Yeah. Right? No, you're not. It's a difficult question. we sound like two arrogant old blokes. Patrick, I'm not. I mean, there are always the unanswerable, unknowable things that, in a perfect world, you'd love to know, right? You know, it's the old Charlie Munger, unfortunately, who did pass away, but who used to say, "Tell me where I'm going to die, so I'll never go there." There is some element of what would I like to know? Well, anything that I don't know that would have a bearing on on the future, and that if I knew it would help me invest better, which, you know, is both absolutely accurate and real, but also not very useful in the context of your question.
Now, by the way, just very, very quick tangent. Mm. What you said there was one of the there's a lot of research going on into prompting with AIs, and in particular, the problem of AGI. And the difficulty is like if you can't know as much as this thing, how do you know what questions to ask? You have to frame it that way. It's like, if I had your kind of insight and knowledge and I had this sort of North Star in mind, what were the things that I should want if I was interested in myself? You know, those kinds of, it's a very sort of second layer. Yeah. Anyway, you just reminded me. I read that recently. Go on.
Nice.
Distraction.
I think I'd... Speaking of AI, as computing, well, see, here's the problem. Anything that's knowable as a fact, once it's known, gets arbitraged away, as Andrew said regularly before. Mm-hmm. So would I like to know the things that actually make the statistically most significant difference for investors that, if done, would improve my results? Yes, I would, absolutely. As soon as that's knowable, it'll be known. As soon as it's known, it'll be shared. As soon as everyone shares it, then there's no upside potential left. So it's kind of one of those. It's a bit of a. I mean, it's a great philosophical question over a couple of beers or a whiskey. But what, you know, if I could only know it myself, of course, that all the things I'd like to know are all the factors that make, you know, statistically make you me more likely to be a more successful investor. That would be the very boring but very honest answer.
Yeah, but then you get to that point of just like, just tell me which share price is going to go up the most in the next 6 months. You get to a point of progression as like if we're hoping for things eventually that we could know that we can't know, well, I might as well go for that one, right?
Yes, yes. That's true. But things that are knowable, which is kind of Patrick's question. I mean, you know, like, for example, I think it's pretty statistically successful that founder CEOs tend to outperform. So, you know, knowing some of those, what they call factor investing, if I could have a list of things that statistically are more likely to make it successful, and I could use data or AI to do that and harness some of those things, I'd like to know those things. The things that, as you, not so much predictions around about what the future is going to be, but the things that have statistically been more likely to add to investment outperformance, I'd probably like to know.
But you can know that now, though, right? I guess I'm doing it. I answered it the same way.
I'll do the things that you can't know, though. The things that we don't know the answer. Things that if we knew more about or had the tools to find out, we could do. So the fantasy AI one, you're right, we can know now. But if there was a... If you say to AI at some point,
I get you. What, yes.
If you say to AI, based on 150 years of public market investments, what have been the factors that have led to the most significant outperformance? It might say buying on a Tuesday, a company starting with W, or it might say founder owners, or it might say sales growth over X percent for the previous 2.5 years. Or, you know, again, I don't know how lucky that would be, but those things, if you could know those sort of, you know, factors that maybe people haven't looked at yet because we haven't had the data or the time or the interest or the energy or the effort or the whatever or the computing power or time to do. I guess I'd like to know those things that would make investing easier. The thing that I would most like to be able to do if I had a total magic wand would be show me the future prices so we could live in the Bahamas. If I could though do something, it would be to better understand my own psychological biases and failures so I could overcome them. To Munger's thing about tell me where I'm going to go so I won't go, where I'm going to die so I won't go there. It would be, I think I've got a pretty good, I'll quote Munger again. You know, Munger said, you know, all his life he reckons he's been in the top 5% of his cohort when it comes to understanding the power of incentives, but he never really still understood it well enough or you know, gave it enough weight. I guess I would probably, in the realm of knowable things, if I could reasonably accurately understand where I am tripping myself up at a high enough level of accuracy and materiality that I could change my investing approach to avoid some of those own goals, That's probably what I'd do. That's probably my answer, Patrick.
Well, yeah, I think I've understood the question a bit better. Sorry, Patrick. Following up from an earlier conversation, I think I would want to know what the culture was like inside the business.
Oh, that's
if cool. I could, if I knew that, and I would very strongly guess, because it is a guess. Yeah. I don't have any hard data, but that a company where the majority of people are really, as we said the other day, love to turn up and are mission driven. I think that would be an incredible edge that you would have as an investor. Mm. And the inverse is true. If you were to be able to look into a company and realize that, it's poison in here. Everyone is miserable. Yeah. They are here because there are no better options for them at this point in time. And the second that a better option comes, they are gone. No matter what else you could give me in terms of, I would probably stay a mile away from that. Now I'll preempt someone here because people are going, I look at that and I look at Glassdoor reviews. So Glassdoor is a website where people sort of review their workplaces. And I don't dismiss that. I think there's some useful insights to be gained there. However, not that useful in the sense that it tends to be the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, in the sense that, you know, it's only the really disgruntled employee that bothers to do that. And there is so much noise on there from HR departments who are anonymously posting, this is such a vibrant workplace that really enables me to, you know, grow to my full potential. And it is, you will find what you are looking for, even if it's not there. So yeah, I would want to know the true read on culture and morale, and that would be massive.
I love that answer. I'm actually really glad you brought up Glassdoor, mate. I'm gonna do something that doesn't make me popular at the Motley Fool. Plenty of people on the Fool, particularly in the US, have talked about Glassdoor, including our CEO, by the way. So speaking of career risk, love you, Tom. If you're listening, I completely agree with you on Glassdoor. I think Glassdoor is a massive false tell. Because of the reasons you've just highlighted. Either you've got a whole lot of HR people saying, hey, say nice things, or a small number of disgruntled people who got retrenched in the last round of layoffs, who just went absolutely to town on the company and makes it seem worse than it is.
And you don't know. It's their side, right? The truth might be that they were a terrible person who never showed up and they're just...
Oh, wonderful, and they're right. But here's the thing, of this is Statistics 101. This is what people should really understand is... If you are not getting a representative sample, or if you don't know if you're getting a representative sample, be very, very careful with any data you're presented with. Mm-hmm. I asked three people on the street and they said this. Yeah, but you happen to ask three 95-year-old women or three 18-year-old boys, or, you know, is it representative of the population? This is why when you see political polling, they make sure that when they get their 1,500 responses, it's the right proportion of men and women, older and younger people, regional and rural and CBD, working, non-working, part-time, full-time. They try and represent the overall circumstance of the population, because they know that matters, right? If you ask three coal miners in Newcastle what they think of climate change, or you ask three basket weavers in Balmain, you are going to get very, very different. You ask three people. 100% of people say coal mining's wonderful. 100% of people say coal mining's terrible. We know, but neither of those is representative, and that's... It makes sense, right? And yet, if you look at Glassdoor and say 15 people who responded don't like their employer or love their employer. My last point on this one, mate, is I worked for a company who, again, I won't name. I do a lot of not naming companies. I'm just trying to keep myself out of trouble here. And they had you ever have a company called the Great Place to Work? I haven't seen a reporter for ages, but for a while, they must be on due soon. These companies do Great Place to Work, right? So they survey and try and find the best places to work. To your point about culture. And again, really, really, you want a great place to work as an employee. You figure out if it's a great place to work, they're probably going to be happier and probably more productive. Not guaranteed, but again, likely. This particular workplace I worked at made very clever. They basically kind of made it a point of pride that the company should win this thing. And so they encouraged all their staff to win the great place to work. They weren't saying, if you think it's a great place to work, vote for us. Like, no, we're a great company. If you think so, we want everyone to think they're a great company. And so it's the old, do you want everyone to love your sports team? Yeah. Do you want everyone to think you're great? Yeah. People, state of origin. I love my state. You love your state. Yeah, let's go and do that. So what they did is they created effectively a sports team mentality. Let's all go and vote for our company so we can win this thing. And went, yeah, let's go and do that. And it was just beautiful to watch. I'm sitting there thinking, these people are being absolutely just completely... you know, not so much misled, just kind of, you know, misdirected into, hey, answer honestly and see how we rank. It was like, no, let's try and win this thing. Let's try and be the number one company because that'd be great.
People aren't idiots, right? Like, I mean,
no, but it worked. That was the thing. It actually worked.
Well, that rings a bell. I've had an experience with something along those lines as well. And right, it's just like, I was miserable, but you know, on my employee survey, it was like the best place to work. I'm not an idiot, right? I'm not going to say that. Well, where is the up? Yes, a, you're not going to do anything about it, right? Like, I know that well enough. All it does is paint a big black X on my back. This guy's trouble. So I was like, shut up. And he said, yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, this is wonderful. I can tick some boxes and be in the good books, or I can tick the wrong boxes and be in the bad books and have nothing change anyway. Correct. So it's all a nonsense. That's why you can't know it, I guess. That's why it's a good thing to want to know if you could, but it's
exactly diabolically
hard to know.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Arzan, I hope that's pronounced correctly. Arzan. Hi, Scott and Andrew. Long-time listener, first-time questioner. Thank you for listening. Thanks for asking. Thanks for your nuanced discussions around investment, says Arzan. Would love your non-personal hypothetical thoughts about something. We've just sold out of the crazy Sydney property market, and we are going to rent for the next 10 years at least. Arzan says, I won't go into the myriad of reasons, but we see better opportunity renting and being flexible in our place of residence rather than being tied down with a large mortgage. So hypothetically, says Arzan, we have just pulled out $500,000 of equity from the house sale. We'd like to put all of this money into an index fund for the S&P 500, which has averaged a total return of 10% per annum over 30 years. We would also like to pull out $50,000 a year from this investment to pay for our rent after paying tax on the returns, he says. My question is, does dollar cost averaging work in reverse? Considering the index makes on average 10% a year, would pulling out that $50,000 a year, including dividends, mean that over time the initial capital will stay at $500,000? I understand that inflation will eat away at the $50,000, so we intend to top up the initial capital to compensate for that. But apart from inflation, is my above reasoning correct? What else am I not considering? Feel free to tear my thoughts apart. Appreciate your thoughts, Arzan.
Oh, Arzan. This resonates. I mean, this is exactly what I did 10 years ago. And I had the same rationale. And I think the math stands up, right? Like it does. If A, then B. Like you're right. If you put that all in there, you get a certain rate of return. Yeah, you've got rent to cover, but you know you've still got other capital that's working there, and it can, depending on what assumptions you use, you can make that very worthwhile. I've mentioned before a couple of times on the podcast how it was one of the bigger regrets I had, not because the maths was wrong, but what happened was what I didn't factor in was just how crap, pardon my language, the rental market is. It is. What threw my calculations out was I didn't know that I was going to get kicked out every 18 months.
Yeah.
And that I would have to like pay double rent for 3 or 4 weeks at a time over the year and would have to front up the costs of moving, and not just to mention the non-financial emotional stress and, you know, having some idiot come in and like, you know, question that you've put some blue tack on the wall. You know, just the most asinine things. It is... I think in a world where if we had the European system of very long-term rentals, I just like, it's a no-brainer. I would 100% do it, right? Like, why wouldn't you get all the benefits of security and long-term, the ability to think long-term and plan long-term, but put your money in far more productive places. So I got that wrong. And I also got the fact, here's what else I missed was I remember at the time thinking, look, I don't really know where the property market's going, but it's not like it's going to double in the next few years. Like, you know, like that's not going to happen. And it did. And like it exactly happened. And it's worse than that is that the money that I invested was unleveraged. I just put the money into the market. And I'm very proud. I'll tell anyone who'll listen. I outperformed the market. I did incredibly well on that. And on that, the capital that I freed up from selling my house did really well. But the property market did well also, not as well as the share market, but if I was leveraged as I would have been in the housing market, like you pay a 20% deposit and you've got another 80% to play around with, the return on your equity became much higher. So it's not a foolproof plan. Is what I am saying, but I nevertheless I have huge sympathy for it and would side and encourage that or almost that approach if it was. If we lived in a different world where you could secure high quality rental tenancy and be treated with respect like a human being. And, you know, where are the consequences if you damage the place or you don't pay your rent? Absolutely. But, you know, barring those two scenarios, if that was a different world that we lived in, I think, yeah, why wouldn't you? You know, but we don't live in that world. And what will throw you potentially is... you'll go through the hell of moving every couple of years. And don't ask the real estate agent if they're after a long-term tenant, because the answer is always yes.
Exactly.
It is always yes. Yeah.
Mate, despite all that, can I draw you on the financial question, though? Assuming that Arzan's going to proceed to it anyway, seems like that's already been done. Seems like Arzan's already sold and wants to rent. The question now is, can Arzan rely on a reverse dollar cost averaging approach and use a portion of the returns or the whole return from the amount being invested to cover the rent for the foreseeable future?
Well, no, either, unfortunately. I mean, it depends on the capital base. We're talking with 500,000. Let's go off that. Mm-hmm. The trouble is that, so we can say with perfect clarity and fact that the share market has over the long-term average 9-10%, you know, with dividends reinvested, et cetera, et cetera. But we know that the reality is it's up 60%, then it's down 30%, then it's down another 20%, then it's up 2%, then it's up 40%. And it may be that this is no prediction, but just hypothetical. It could be that next year is the year that the market drops 50%. And now you've got $250,000 worth of capital and you're withdrawing $50,000 out. So now you've got $200,000. Right. So you've just gotten rid of a fifth of your capital where you're only planning on getting rid of 10% of your capital. And
the return you need from that lower base needs to be even higher to get back to where you started from now, because you've taken out the low price.
Now, it could be that next year or the coming year is the year that the market triples. And I was like, hey, this works really well. So it's why it makes more sense at very larger values, because you drawing that amount down isn't going to be too fundamentally altering the overall capital base. But with 500,000 is not an insignificant amount of money, not by any stretch of the imagination, but you really could be a forced seller under that scenario. So I tend to prefer that approach. If you're going to go that approach, I would try and be more reliant on the dividend side of the returns. They will fluctuate as well, but nowhere near the extent of share prices. So if we have a recession, Woolies might cut its dividend or hold it steady for a few years, but it's not going to be a 30-40% drawdown in your overall wealth very rapidly. So does that make sense?
It does entirely. And I think that's the right approach. Honestly, Arzan, no one knows. It may well be that from here you could do that perfectly fine. If the market goes up first, stays higher, you get a couple of 15% returns, and then it's volatile after that, you're probably okay. If it falls first or falls meaningfully in the first few years, to Ram's point, the impact of that, if you have to take money out and make that kind of work for you permanently or essentially permanently, that can be pretty problematic. So it's an open question, I think, as to whether or not it can work. Hypothetically, could it work? Yes. Would I want to rely on it? No. It's the same reason we say to people, any money you've got in the market, or any money you put in the market, should be money you don't need for 3 to 5 years or more. I would suspect you might be able to do something like that if you had a cash buffer to allow for that fact that if the market did halve, you didn't have to then find 50 grand by selling those shares at the bottom. Because it is harder if you're not adding more money to the portfolio to then get that growth to work. You'll work out the maths for yourself. But basically, you know, to add that 50 grand, if your portfolio falls to 200 grand, if it's 50 the first time, then it's 25% the next time if it doesn't go up. And then it gets lower. So you could actually wipe yourself out if your timing end up being unfortunate. If I was going to do something like that, again, to Ram's point, I probably wouldn't. I wouldn't want my bills to be reliant on that and have to be a forced seller. But if I was going to do something like that, I'd want to make sure I had cash first and then went from there. Having the cash matters because it allows you to choose when you're going to sell. We have an income service at the Motley Fool I've talked about before. I'm not going to sell it. But we do it by basically making sure you've got an amount of money So we have a cash buffer. So we say to our members, draw your monthly income out of this cash pocket and refill that cash pocket with dividends over time. We also, by the way, don't make that particularly aggressive. We're not taking 10% out. So a strategy like this, more often than not, should or could work. I would take out a lower percentage and I make sure I had a cash buffer of a couple of years, maybe 3 to 5 years, ideally, of cash in the first place. Now, that's a very different thing. If you're saying 50 grand a year and you want 3 to 5 years worth, that's 150 to 250 grand. That takes a big chunk out of your 250 or your 500 that you started with. But that's how I'd do it. I wouldn't want to rely on that. Again, you might do it, it might be fine. But you might do it and it might go badly. And once that platform starts burning, once you are having money coming off lower and lower balances, It's a one way. You can't make enough money back, or you'll be very, very unlikely to make enough money back to cover those sales made at low prices.
Yeah.
Is that fair, Ray?
Yeah, I mean,
that's a good question.
It's a great question. I mean, I really get it. And periodically you see people write about this sort of rent versus mm-hmm. buy, what's the most effective use? And there's some really good arguments, I think, on both sides. So there's no right or wrong mm-hmm. answer.
Exactly.
Just to emphasize the non-financial dimension to it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I say it from lived experience, right?
Yeah. I think that's right. The other thing I'd say, again, is theoretically, if it works 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, that means 1% of the time, you know, for every 100 people that try it, one person goes broke doing it. And it's like, do you really want to be that person? Do you really want that to be the... So both from an experiential perspective and a financial perspective, not going back to square one is the most important thing. So just don't run it so close to the wire that you do run that risk. Even if it's a sensible idea, either for a lifestyle reason, for answers, or financial, as I say, in both cases, don't run so close to the line that you don't have room for enough room for a large enough error.
Yep, that's it. I mean, it's really the drawdown element of that question that makes it trickier than it otherwise
exactly
would be.
It
if it yep. was just like, I'm going to put that in the market and then continue to work and that will provide my living costs, it's like, oh, that is much more. It just adds a little, especially it's 10% every year, it can swing things.
Well, could I take it out if I wanted to? Is different from I have to take it out, in which case you are locked in.
Different story, absolutely. Correct. Like, correct. Why wouldn't you? You know, particularly it's just sort of like, again, money's there to be enjoyed. It has a use. If there is, I can really do something of quality and lasting for me and my family, and market happens to be roaring, like, well, yeah, why not? But it's a superpower to be able to say, well, things are really bad right now, but I'm not a forced seller. I'll be here for the recovery. It'll get better.
Yeah. Jason says, hi, Scott. I have always enjoyed your upfront views and opinions. This is directed at me, mate, but I'm going to throw it at you as well. You mentioned in your podcast that you like to invest in companies whose management has skin in the game. Using the same principle, I'd be interested to find out whether your regular personal investments align with your monthly best buys for ShareAdvisor. Regards, Jason. And we've had a similar question in the past, so I will address it very quickly. That's worth asking. Very good question. Mate, probably 90, I don't know the number, so I'm going to make it up. Conservatively, more than 90%, or probability more than 95% of my portfolio is made up of companies that we've recommended at ShareAdvisor, either in the US or here in Australia. I'm precluded from selling anything that we have as an active recommendation. So anything I buy is locked in. There are a couple of reasons where there are companies that either haven't made the scorecard for one reason or another. I own some Fortescue shares. I never felt comfortable enough to make it a recommendation for ShareAdvisor because of the style of service that it is, but I bought some for myself. I've done that a couple of times at a couple of different companies. There's very, very, very little I still own now that is not a ShareAdvisor recommendation in one form or another. I'm not obliged to. I think it's the right thing to do. I'd have to have a very good reason to buy something that I didn't recommend to my members first. In fact, that's always been my approach. If I buy something, I'm going to buy something new. My first question to myself is, if I'm going to do it, shouldn't I tell members first? If the answer is no, because of whatever, and again, Fortescue was that example, I bought it. I didn't recommend it to ShareAdvisor because I didn't think the company fit the bill. Otherwise, yes, absolutely. I think it's 100%. The right way to go. There are some circumstances where maybe for different reasons I might not. I'll give you a single one. I can't sell anything. If I want to sell some of my portfolio for whatever reason, pay off a mortgage or buy a car or whatever I wanted to do with the money, I actually couldn't do it under the Motley Fool's trading rules. So there is a slightly weird disincentive there. If I invested in something else, if I want to sell my Fortescue shares, I can do it tomorrow. If I want to sell shares in, I've mentioned Kogan. It's a recommendation of ours. It's one I own. I couldn't sell them, even if I wanted to. So it makes sense for me, at least on a personal financial flexibility perspective, to have investments outside my scorecard for exactly that reason. I could possibly ask for a dispensation to sell, and I'd probably get it if I advise members first, hey, I'm going to sell my Kogan shares because I'm going to, I don't know, what am I going to do with the money? I probably could, and I probably get it, and I probably explain it to members. It's just painful and, you know, difficult. And so there is a slight disincentive there for our team to actually do that. But we figure it's the least worst outcome. Your thoughts, Ram, in general and for you personally?
Yeah, I mean, I always put a big weight on people who eat their own cooking. I think I've mentioned it before. It's more obvious in the context of funds, and there are some really good, you know, fund managers out there. That's just the rule. If you work for us, all your money's got to be in the fund. Like you live or die by the results here, not just for our business and the customers, but you personally. They are the exception to the rule, but, you know, it doesn't guarantee success, but, you know, everyone's trying.
Yeah, that's kind of all you need. As I said, there are reasons why not. I think I've said before, I've had questions from people saying, well, hang on, you're biased. You're talking your own book now because you own them. That's why you're recommending them. And, you can't please everybody. And I asked on Twitter, not the Twitter's the arbiter of these things, but I got to the point one day, I was like, you know, I'm going to ask people what they think. And I said, look, would you rather me own what I recommend so you know I have conviction, or would you rather me own nothing? You know, would I do it? I professionally and reputationally, if I felt like our members would be better treated by me having only index funds, for example, and recommending stocks, and that way there could be no conflict, I would probably do it. I'd have to give a bit of return to do that, probably, if I'm half good at picking stocks, because if I beat the market, then buying the market means I would sacrifice my own returns. But if it felt like it was the right thing to do for members, I'd do it. So I did ask people. I said, what would you prefer? People complain about me either not owning the stocks that I recommend and therefore not having skin in the game, or having skin in the game, therefore being conflicted and talking my book. Yeah, some people you can't please. I'm like, well, which would you prefer? And about two-thirds of people said, you know, it might have been more than that, skin in the game, we'd rather you own the stocks. And that is the approach I would take anyway. So I was pretty relieved, frankly, to have that as the answer. As I said, not that it's scientific, but you can't please everybody.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I mean, there's plenty of stuff I own that I would definitely not recommend for close family and friends, which nothing to do with, you know, to be condescending towards them, but I know their temperaments and I know that they wouldn't.
Totally. It's important.
I know that they would go from loving me to hating me and vice versa 100 times, and it's just sort of like, it's not
that. That's a really good point.
That worth it. So there are investments that you, Scott Phillips, might love, hand on heart, love this to death, but I don't think it's right for you. And that, not in a condescending way, but just recognizing that it's not going to be for everyone. So I've always and I know this is what the Fool does, and I did when I was there as well, which was all you can do is put out your rationale. And too often, and this was the frustration that you have, right, is that people just hear buy or sell. That's what people hear. And we would write, and I know you guys still do, you write up a whole report, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, well, we like it. Obviously, it's a buy. But here's what can go wrong. Be aware of this. These might be riskier or less riskier than normal. There is context around all of that kind of stuff. And that context matters a hell of a lot. So it's all about trying to arm people, I think, to enable them to make the most informed decision that they can. And you sleep very easy at night, whether you own the shares or not, if that's the kind of situation that it needs to be. And I know I say this every time these kinds of questions come up, and it comes across very harsh, but you know, you don't get to blame anyone if an investment goes bad, even if someone gave you the idea. And it sounds like that's what a finance guy would say, is like, well, wait a sec, no, that's not right. But it is. This is a very nasty industry full of self-interested people with lots of snouts in the trough. You know, their business model isn't, well, yeah, they'll try and make you good returns if you can, but you know, that when the ducks quack, feed them, right? You are far better off out there peddling sexy narratives and, you know, trying to attract huge amounts of flows rather than focusing too much on investors. So it's you don't know anyone, even if you've listened to us every week for the last 10 years, like you don't know us. And I just feel as though it's such an important thing to really internalize, not to be nasty, but when you accept that truth that you are accountable for your capital allocation investment decisions, you will think harder about it and you will get better results. So, you know, okay, I subscribe to The Fool. Scott says he likes this. He says it's a buy. Okay, great. That's a really good signal. It's just, as I've said before, it's kind of like a filter, right? It's 2,000 stocks and this guy's gone through, he seems to know a thing or two. He's gone through a bunch and he's put this one forward. He's just passed the baton to you. Now you've got to build up your own conviction, because, you know, you're not going to be able to pick up the phone to Scott, you know, on a Tuesday when the stocks just dropped 15%. Is this good or bad? What do I do now? Yeah, you know, and it's sort of lean into that, because too often you see, again, like you and I have been in the industry for a long time, and people take away the wrong lessons, and people can end up sort of acting in counterproductive ways. And usually it'll go like this, like, I've got to invest in the share market because my money's doing nothing, locked out of property or something. I've got to, you know, I'm going to do it. They do it. They have one or two bad early experiences, and the whole thing's a con, and this company's full of crooks, and I'm out. And you slump off in a cynical cloud. And who's suffering there? And, you know, it's sort of like you've just talked yourself out of a lifetime of wealth creation potential, which is full of all kinds of missteps and backward steps. And that's just the nature of the game. And, you know, it's on you at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And when you get that, you will be far, far more diligent. And as I say, you'll get better results.
Yeah. I add a couple of things to that, mate, because it's really good. I think I said before, we occasionally have members, I think I've written about this, we occasionally have a member who bad mouths on social media or one of those, you know, comparison websites or whatever, says, oh, I bought this stock and it went badly and those bastards lost me money. Now, I feel bad about that, and I feel sorry for that, and I don't ever want, in a perfect world, to give our members anything that loses them money, because why would I want to do that? It's bad, right? I don't want that to happen. The reality, though, is that it's going to happen because we're not perfect. No one's perfect. Buffett's lost money. Some of his companies gone broke as well. So the reality is, when we have people join our service, we say, this is how you should use the service. Be long-term, be diversified, buy 15 to 25 stocks, play the long game, expect losses. We go to a huge amount of effort to do that. And yet people will join us, buy one stock, lose money on that stock, call us scammers, and go bad.
And when you say lose money on the stock too, it's often the case of sort of like your best stocks underperform for the first 3 months before they're, months or 2 years, you know? And it's sort of like, so when you say it was a bad recommendation, it's like, well, it didn't immediately fire to the moon, but actually if you'd held on for 5 years, you would have done really well.
Yes. And by the way, some absolutely have flamed out entirely.
Oh, of course, of course.
And so we saw people mention, we recommended a retail food group like 8 years ago, whatever it was. And I still occasionally see someone post on social media, it's like, dude, move on. Like, you know, did it suck? Yes. Was it a mistake? Yes. Have we made them since? Yes. Are we going to make more? Yes. My point isn't to absolve us of responsibility, Ram. It's to say that the reality is you have to take the full advice, not just the bit of advice you want to take and then wonder why it didn't work out. You can't make a cake using one ingredient, saying, I used the flour and the flour sucked, I didn't make a good cake. Like, well, what do you expect, you know? So there's that, and that's important. I think the other thing I'd probably say, in terms of thinking about the returns you're getting, what you're doing, I'm going to go a bit further than you did, mate, and say there are too many people buying individual shares and there are too many people with self-managed super funds. And that is not what I would say if I was anyone else in our industry trying to sell more stuff to more people. If I get some sucker to use my service and send me some money to do that, then most in our industry would say, yeah, I'll take all your money. I will say right here and right now and very clearly, to your point before, mate, if you can't, you're right to say, Scott will give you a recommendation, you choose what to do with that. If your view is, or your result is, I still don't know what to do with this information, then do nothing with it.
Yeah.
And if you want to go and buy an index ETF and invest in that, listen to the podcast for fun, go fishing and just ETF index through for the rest of your life, go for it. Please do. Please do that if you're not someone who wants to, can, is comfortable with, knows enough about investing to buy individual stocks. You shouldn't be doing it. It's not necessary. To your point, Ram, you don't want to leave money in cash. I completely agree with that. But there's a million options that don't require you to pick stocks, to deal with the volatility, to deal with whatever. By the way, if you don't like the volatility of the index either, because the market crashed 38% in early 2020, then don't do that either. But know that this is the endeavor that you're in. Know that this is what sort of thing that happens. If you don't want to or can't deal with it, please don't do it, because you are going to be the person who sells out in a fit of pique when the market falls. You sell out. See, I knew I shouldn't have done this. That was stupid. I'm going back to cash. You've locked in a loss. You've missed out the subsequent opportunities. It is literally the worst of all worlds. So I want more people to invest. I want more people to buy stocks. I want more people to take control of their financial futures. But if picking stocks is not for your temperament or your interest or your effort, don't do it, please. But do something entirely different. Don't do it half-heartedly. That's the worst of all worlds.
Yeah. And look, I'll just add too, this is why I'm very fond of saying that investment returns are earned. You know, they yeah. It's very easy to look at someone and go, oh, he bought Afterpay when it was 50 cents and look, wow, you know, lucky. How lucky is that? And look, there's always an element of luck in life and investing and everything. But what you don't, what you miss for the person who, let's go with Fortescue, who bought that when it was like 10 cents a share and rode that to the moon. Did they earn that? Well, they bought when no one else liked it. They had 1,000 opportunities to take money off the table and lock in a ridiculously good profit. And along the way, every stock that goes to the moon has these gut-wrenching drawdowns, 10, 20, 30%. You pick a stock, you know, well, Altium, let's let go with that. It's gone to the moon. You know, there's like plenty of gut-wrenching moments. That person didn't just get lucky. They do you realize that they went through hell and back to get that return? Yeah, you know, right. they was strapped yeah. to the mast and the siren songs were just there and they didn't budge. They held on. All of the things that attract all of us to the share market are the stories of the multi-bagger returns, that just those life-changing ones. And again, they are earned, but you have to earn those returns. Yes, because you've done the work and you've thought about it sensibly and stuff, but also because you've had the strength of conviction and the fortitude of character sort of hang through all of that kind of stuff. And you're not going to get that from a newsletter. You're not going to get that from reading a book. You're going to really some internal contemplation and, you know, just practice, I think, with all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, this is why we're not going any further in this industry, you and I, because the reality is that these are not comfortable truths and is really very counterproductive to the businesses that we operate. But that is why when you see marketing in this space, it is always guaranteed, you know, virtually. It's like, look at this. It's only the upside that is being spoken about. It is none of the cautionary tale. Why? Because you don't want to, you're trying to sell a product or a service here. Like it doesn't, Don't. Steve Jobs doesn't go out there and say, look at the iPhone. It's fantastic. By the way, the screen will crack in an instant as soon as you drop it. Don't at me, Apple people. I don't know what the story is, but you know what I mean? Like you don't emphasize those kinds of things. And just remember that when you're in the market, like the market for financial services, there'll be a bloke, because it's always a bloke, on every street corner with a sandwich board saying, come to me, I'm going to solve all your problems. And the people with the biggest line in front of them are those that are going to be making the bigger promises. The person in the corner saying, oh, I'm not responsible for what you do with my information. Oh, I'm going to make lots of mistakes. And even when I do well, it's not going to go immediately well. But I think you'll do pretty well over time on average. There's no one standing in front of that person. but we're dumb enough to sort of put that out there and say it and just wear the consequences. But it's the truth. It's the truth.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. Mate, I think that's the... Yes. Investing is hard and it doesn't... Index investing is easy. maybe that's the returns are on offer. If you want to grab them. It's why, by the way, well, not why, but 80% of managed funds generally underperform the index. It's not just individual investors, right? 4 out of 5 fund managers should go and find another job if those numbers are right, and they are. Some investors aren't meant to be investors, and that's okay too, at least not in terms of picking stocks. Have a go. It's worth it. If you're interested, if you're keen, if you want to spend the time and effort and energy, if you want to learn, if you want to grow and develop as an investor, if you want to try and, you know, replicate the returns of some other people who've done really, really well, go for it. Just know your limitations, know your realities. I don't fix my own car. You know, part of me would love to learn, but I also know that I probably not have the dexterity or aptitude for it and take a long time. So I don't do it. I get someone else to do it for me. And that's completely okay. Don't get a scumbag, to Andrew's point, from our industry to do it for you, because I'll just rob you blind. But you don't have to, you know, I guess the benefit is there's no index investing equivalent to getting your car fixed, right? But there is in investing. And that's great. It's such a fantastic thing to be able to go out there and do that. So yeah, you know, do the work. Earn the returns, to Ram's point. If you want to go and do it, go and do it. But if you're not that person, please don't. The worst outcome from this podcast would be someone who listened for 5 years, went, you know what, I'm finally going to take the plunge. They sold their house or they had an inheritance or something. They put all the money into some stupidly small number of stocks. One went badly for a little bit of time, as you said, Ram. They sell the whole lot, give it up, lose 100 grand, walk away and say, I'm never doing that again. you know, that's a real loss. That's a real loss. I would hate that to be the case. I think we can help people do well if you listen to the whole thing and put the whole thing to work. But please don't take part of, not that any of this is advice, but don't take part of what we say. Don't say one thing and say, oh, once upon a time they said you should do this. Investing is a discipline. It's a pursuit. It requires effort and energy and education and learning and all that kind of stuff. So please, if you're going to do it, go for it. But please do it properly.
Yeah. Shouldn't talk you out of it too much. I mean, it is very rewarding. And I'm not talking totally financially. Like, well, hopefully it's rewarding financially, of course. But it is. I've always thought that there's investing is, you know, at the periphery, it looks like it's just making money. But I think it's one of the few vocations that forces you to have such a broad world view, because need to understand I'm ultimately trying to figure out which share price goes up. But to do that, I need to understand which business is going to perform well, which means I need to understand business, uh-huh. which I need to understand how society works, which means I need to understand, you know, what people value. I mean, you get very foundational on this kind of stuff very quickly, but it forces, again, you mentioned Munger before, he was sort of saying, you know, if you can be someone who understands the top 7 or 8 concepts of every discipline, of all the big ones, you know, you have so many mental models at your disposal to make money, frankly, but it's also, it's endlessly stimulating, because the people who win in investing aren't the ones with the most powerful spreadsheets. They're the ones who see the world for what it is and effectively see the future, at least more often than not. And if you want to have any ability to see the future, which is what investing is, you got Buckley's if you don't understand how the world works. And it goes far beyond what a discounted cash flow is, or a price earnings ratio what the net profit margin is. Like, it's sort of, so let me put in a case for the direct investment. It is masochistic. Yes, it is. but it is incredibly rewarding. And especially when you do get it right, like it can change your life. And of course, the final thing we should say is it's not an either or kind of thing. We've often said that if you're not sure, 80% of your capital in an ETF, and then maybe 20% as you learn and as your confidence and conviction and aptitude grows, then you can tilt the scales in more of the opposite direction. But it does start with knowing thyself and what you're in for, and the pros and the cons and the goods and the bads.
That's a really good summary, Matt, because you're right. I don't want to discourage anybody either. I know people in my life who shouldn't be investing their own money. Because they're just not suitable for it. And I would never say to that person, you know what, you should really try, you should really do this, you should really, you know, eventually, maybe, possibly you'll get it, and eventually you'll be the right temperament and, you know, approach and interest and whatever. And I'll use my mother as an example. She won't mind me doing this. She shouldn't be investing, right? It's not her thing. And that's okay. That's completely okay. I mean, she got me to help her, obviously. But, you know, but you're right. If you are someone who, frankly, if you're listening to this at this point, particularly in the podcast, you're probably interested and engaged enough to actually go over and do it. And I think those people should absolutely consider whether it's right for them. And if they do think it's right for them, give it a go. I 100% agree with you, mate. I don't want people to feel like they have no choice but to do it despite their misgivings, because those are the people who really should take the easier option or the less risky option. And again, at some point, if you do keep listening, then to Andrew's point, you do want to go and put some money to work, then do it. Buy the individual company after that. If you're not sure, you don't want to do it, you feel like you're being kind of not pushed into it by us, but not by us at all. But if you know, don't invest reluctantly, you know. Do it objectively, do it actively, do it thoughtfully, choicefully, which is a horrible word, but you get my point. Do that for sure. So yeah, you're right, mate. Thanks for calling me out. I'm not trying to discourage anybody. I just want anyone who does it to really understand what they're getting into and how to think about the way they're going to proceed with that. Starting, you know, the old half an idea is dangerous. Don't start unprepared. That's the really dangerous angle.
To stretch your analogy further, there'd be plenty of mechanics who out there would be going, it is incredibly rewarding to understand how an engine works and how to put it together.
Yes, that's
and
a great point.
You can save a lot of money and you can get a better performance out of it. And they're 100% right. And there'll be people out there going, I could really get into that. That's really cool. I love that kind of stuff. And there's others like yourself and me too, frankly, just like, it's not my thing. And I know what I'm good at and what I'm not. I'm not good at that stuff. You know, if you've got a busted, you know, pipe, don't call me, right? Because I'm just going to make the situation worse. But again, as I said before, know thyself. And that is the absolute starting point.
That's a great point. And on that point, that is also our finishing point. Until next Wednesday, if you're still listening and you are on the Gold Coast, remember, go to fool.com.au/money so you can come and join us for a podcast recording on Wednesday, the 27th of March. As I said, if you listen to this after the 27th, don't turn up next Wednesday. We won't be there. Also, to hit us up on all of the socials and via email if you have a question, comment, any feedback, go to info@fool.com.au. Probably the best way to throw a longer question at us. Now, if you want to follow us on social media, just want to engage, please feel free to do that. Andrew is exclusively on Twitter @Sage_Simeon or @StrawmanInvest. I am far more, what's the polite word of saying I'm everywhere? Not sure. We'll think about that. I am on Twitter
omnipotent.
@TMF. That's an
omnipresent.
Omnipresent. Well, I'd like to omnipotent it better, but thank you. Let's go to Twitter and Instagram @TMFScottP. I am on Facebook @ScottPhillipsMoney. Until Wednesday, when we see you in person, until Friday, when that episode goes up on the podcast machine. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.